ABC Radio.
You're listening to Nightlife.
Nightlife with Philip Clark.
How might a better understanding of animal health improve human health? It's a question which Dr. Matt Morgan investigates in his new book, One Medicine. Animals are separated from humans by, in some cases, a very small degree. Do their bodies work like ours? Have they solved issues in their own health that we haven't? These days, we regard the use of animal tissues in humans as relatively commonplace, I guess. Cardiac patients are regularly fitted with heart valves from pigs. Indeed, a pig heart has been transplanted into a human, although not that successfully. But might this be the future of human medicine, and is a better understanding of animal health a prerequisite to a better understanding of human health? All good questions. Dr. Matt Morgan joins us this evening. Matt, good evening and welcome to Nightlife.
Thank you, Phil. Thank you for asking me.
It's a terrific, it's a great conjecture in a way, because apart from the dangers of anthropomorphizing everything, I suppose, there is a real question here. Is that one of the ones that I thought about when I was reading your book is, do animals get as sick as humans and in the same way?
Yeah, great question. I guess yes, in many ways, especially through accidents and trauma and infection. Yes, they do. I guess the difference in humans is we have long been trying to alter human physiology by dampening down immune systems, by doing things perhaps we shouldn't, like alcohol and drugs and other things. So that perhaps does put humans into a different special place in many ways. They can get ill in different ways, perhaps, than some animals can.
Mm. Yeah, let's go through some of the things that are completely fascinating in this book. What can we learn from kangaroo reproduction that might help human survival?
Well, I couldn't publish this book in Australia without talking about kangaroos, and it also talks about koalas that we'll maybe talk about later. But I was fascinated with this first IVF successful pregnancy, which was in Louise Brown many years ago now.
Famously so, yes.
Really famously so, you know, born in the UK. And people think the tricky bit about that was the fertilization, the kind of God moment, if you like. But in fact, looking through the history, that artificial fertilization was actually the relatively easy bit. The difficult bit is then sustaining that pregnancy through what we call implantation. So when the embryo grows into the lining of the womb, if you like. And scientists struggled with this for many, many years, for decades, and it's why IVF took so long to successfully happen. But the breakthrough really came when studying mammals like marsupials, you know, who were at that tipping point between egg-laying and live-bearing mammals. And I guess it's no wonder they would hold the key to this, because they are the first creatures that cracked the mystery, you know, not only kangaroos, but here I'm talking to you from Perth, and of course we have the quokka on Rottnest Island, for example. And it was studying the way they deal with implantation that scientists found out that inflammation is really important to this.
Tell me about that. Why? Because here's the thing, isn't it? That's right. Fertilization in the laboratory was, well, it wasn't easy to achieve, but it was achieved long before implantation became possible.
Yeah. Spot on. And a part of the reason was scientists were long trying to dampen down inflammation in the womb. And that kind of makes sense. You know, you want to look after the embryo, make it as calm as you can. So they would use drugs a bit like aspirin and ibuprofen and naproxen to dampen down inflammation. But it was studying marsupial pregnancy that they really discovered you need some implantation, you need some inflammation to allow that to happen. And it was then that was the breakthrough in using different drugs, using novel methods in order to encourage that.
Mm. Yes, indeed. It's the survival of premature babies, speaking of implantation and then survival of premature babies, we also learnt something of this from the animal world, didn't we? That I was amazed to read just how important human touch is in the survival of premature babies. It's not just an emotional thing, is it?
Yeah, and I think a lot of the things in this book, in a way, are surprising, But if you think about it from the fundamental perspectives, it kind of shouldn't be. You know, of course, being there for our children, touching them, holding them is important. But we've kind of lost that perspective in many ways through, you know, the sterilization of modern medicine. And the book explores what is called kangaroo care, actually, in premature baby units, but is probably better described as primate or ape care. And it looks at the work of an anthropologist called Robin Dunbar, who discovered some fascinating things, including Dunbar's number, where he describes how many relationships we can successfully maintain in modern life. And the number for humans is around 150, which matches up with lots of research in social media and life. But Dunbar also discovered that to sustain relationships in the primate kingdom, they use grooming. And when I say grooming, I mean, you know, physical grooming of primates, you know, looking for bugs, touching each other's skin and so on. But the point of that isn't really for cleanliness. It's not really
which it looks like.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is effective for that too. But what it allows are those social bonds to be reinforced time after time in bigger and bigger groups. And he discovered that there are receptors in the skin of primates and in humans which respond exactly to light touch at about 2 meters per second, which is stroking and grooming. And it's no wonder now we know in premature babies, if mum has skin-to-skin contact or other parents have skin-to-skin contact, touch and hold their babies, that actually releases powerful chemicals, which are a bit like strong painkillers. These babies do better.
Remarkably better, actually.
Absolutely.
It's not just an incremental improvement, is it? It's quite dramatic.
No, it's a huge improvement, you know, more so than some of the medicines that we use in modern premature baby units. And so this is now pretty routine, but it hasn't been for decades. And if we'd only looked at the practices in other non-human animals, perhaps we could have worked that out sooner. And it's not just the touch that Dunbar has shown is important. The same receptors in skin are in our middle ear.
Really?
And they respond, absolutely, and they respond to things like your wonderful voice. You know, it's no wonder listeners like listening to you so much because you're tuning in exactly to those frequencies, relatively low, you know, predictable frequencies, the same as in chanting, the same as in nursery rhymes, that kind of tempo. And these receptors release the same chemicals as grooming receptors.
How about that? Because we were only talking the other night, actually, about how one marker for dementia was, unfortunately, there's an association with deafness. Now, if you're deaf, don't get thinking that there's an absolute link. There isn't, but there's an association between deafness and dementia.
Spot on. And again, you know, that's kind of surprising, but in many ways it kind of shouldn't be. It's one of our key senses, how we interact with others, how we interact with the world. And if that's taken away, you know, perhaps there's even a role for these receptors that Dunbar has discovered. So, yeah.
I like this one. This is a bit yucky, but you know what? We have to deal with it. What can we learn from koala feces? And why this helps the young to eat gum leaves, and why, in essence, are humans a bit the same?
Yeah, thank you for asking that, and I hope it's not breakfast or dinner or lunchtime for people listening. But the chapter is actually entitled, and I won't swear, it's Why You Should Eat Your Own Swear Word, which is another word for poo. And the story really goes that we now know things like fecal transplants and the microbiome you can read about in lots of science and medical news.
It's become a thing, hasn't it? Yes.
It's all the rage. And, you know, sometimes its benefits are over-exaggerated if you look at Hollywood celebrities doing it for very dubious reasons. But there are real medical advantages to doing that in certain conditions. And again, this is being purported as new and groundbreaking. But if you look at the koala population here in Western Australia, where there were no native koalas here until they were imported up in Yanchep, We went to see them actually with my children just a few weeks ago. And when they were first introduced in Yanchep in Western Australia, they really struggled. They couldn't digest the local eucalyptus. And the reason for that is that digesting of that requires a certain mix of bacteria in its gut, in its microbiome. And so the keepers at the time had a very good idea, and that was to import the feces, the poo, of koalas who could digest that local eucalyptus species from elsewhere, feed it to the koalas here, and hopefully change their microbiome. And that's exactly what happened. And it worked. And again, it shouldn't be a massive surprise because we know young koalas purposely have a big meal of their mother's feces, known as cloaca, shortly after birth for this very reason.
See, and you say in your book, most babies actually are born facing their mother's bottom.
Yes.
And
yes.
And without wishing to get too dramatic about all this, birth is a messy affair, regardless of what you've seen in the movies, and that no baby and nobody has been there knows that babies do not come out all clean and shiny. But one of the things they come in contact with is human feces, isn't it?
Absolutely, and it's no coincidence that babies are born facing that way around. You know, the medical term is OA, but you're right, face to bottom. And, you know, that's presumably has an evolutionary advantage. And we now think, and there is some evidence for this, although it's not conclusive by any means, that human babies are designed to have exposure to mum's feces shortly after birth. And, you know, although that sounds odd, again, it makes perfect sense. We want to pass on the microbiome from mum to baby to help with those early stages of life.
In the same way that the koala is doing.
Spot on. And if you compare that to babies faced the other way, or OP, for example, or through cesarean birth or through other means, they have radically different microbiomes. And there may be an association between higher rates of autoimmune disease, higher rates of things like diabetes and other. Mm-hmm. Again, these are not conclusive things, and it's not only about that. So, you know, don't go and feed babies' feces by any means.
Because
it's not medical.
This has got a bit. That's right. This has got a bit out of control, hasn't it? Because there are those who think that, you know, that cesarean babies born by cesarean section, for example, or in breech births and other should have this substance administered. But that's not probably wise, is it?
No, absolutely not. And we're not at that stage of the evidence. There's, you know, zero advice or evidence saying that. But again, all of these things we need to look at as a whole and not just be so blinkered on human species and human animals. You know, we need to look at all of the other species to form a solid conjecture of what I called and what the book is called, which is One Medicine.
One Medicine, yes. I'd like to talk about some more about this in a moment. One of the ideas behind your book, of course, is that we are all much closer than we think. What do you think about that? Are we? Well, you reflect on this at the end of your book, whether we are all one set of animals, as it were, because we don't tend to think of ourselves that way, do we?
Yeah, you know, it's natural to think of humans as special. And in many ways, you know, perhaps we are. There are some things that humans do that, you know, other species can't. But I prefer to think of it as, you know, all animal species are remarkable and special in other ways. You know, can you imagine what it would be like to be a bat and, you know, navigate using sonar? What is it like to be, you know, a dolphin and have that communication skills that they use, or to be an ant and have genetics which design you to work implicitly in a colony? You know, it's all unimaginable in many ways. And this isn't diminishing the fact that humans are a remarkable species, but so are all of the other species. You know, I finished the book, actually. I've got it in front of me, and the last sentence says, I used to think that I worked only with humans, but now I know I work only with animals. And I think, you know, that's
a good thing. Is that it? Do you think we all... Because I said a lot of people might have issue with that. They would think, no. This is the whole point about Homo sapiens, is that we we are at a, we are genetically close, but at a remove, and that's an important remove because we have things that other animals, well, that animals generally don't.
Yeah, of course, we absolutely do. But what I do?
Well, I wonder about that. Do you? Not sorry to interrupt, but I mean, I wonder what you think is therefore special about it. Some people say, well, we can reflect. We've got capacities for abstract thought and so on that makes us different from animals. What do you think about that?
Yeah, well, you know, certainly since the time of Darwin and others, those special abilities, as you like, have become more and more eroded, more and more diluted.
Mm.
You know, pretty much most things that humans can do that people think are special do now have corollaries in other species, you know, be that communication, be that the thought of memes, you know, passing on skills from generation to generation. That's been shown in primates who can extract ants using tools from nests, for example, and so on. Even more primitive, if you want to use that word, species such as birds can do this, such as magpies in accessing water through using stones. So pretty much all of those special abilities, if you like, have been eroded. And again, it kind of doesn't matter in an extra way, in that there are also many, many things that animals do that humans can never do, such as, you know, see the way bats see or the way that even flies see. So thinking there's this kind of somehow hierarchical structure and say these are at the top, these are at the middle, these are at the bottom, it just doesn't make sense, really.
No, I suppose it doesn't. I mean, some might say, well, humans are paramount because they are the ones that have are so successful at modifying their environment, and humans are also the only people who engage in collective thought that benefits individuals other than their immediate surroundings. I mean, the example's often been given of the fact that, you know, people fly in aeroplanes even though they've got no idea who built them or who's flying the aeroplane either, for that matter, because we trust each other.
Yeah, I certainly think that humans are, you know, the most successful species at using those memes and standing on the shoulders of giants in order to achieve remarkable technological advantages, of course. But then to say that, you know, if you put a human in this, you know, Sahara desert with no food, no water, then it would be far less successful than some of the arthropods and insects there. So I think successful is a term which very much depends on your definition of success. And of course, there's lots of things that only humans have done, which are terrible things. You know, we need to only look at the world now. You're right. We can impact the world in amazing and terrible ways.
Mm. Back to animals. What can we learn about the giraffe? I love this one. See, the giraffe is an improbable animal because its head and brain are way too far away from its abdomen, where all the important organs are. Its windpipe is way too long. None of this should work. I mean, when the giraffe is walking along, it should become extremely lightheaded, because how on earth is blood going to pump up there?
It is a completely crazy animal. You know, just to look at it, you know that. But then when you look into the physiology and the anatomy, it's even crazier. You know, my day job is working in the intensive care unit, and I often care for patients with severe brain injuries, with major problems with their lungs, for example. And the giraffe can give us amazing lessons about how we treat those kinds of problems. So just taking the brain, as you've mentioned, it needs to pump blood up 2 meters or more up towards its brain from its heart.
Yeah.
And to do that, it has the highest blood pressure of all land mammals.
Does it have an especially big heart?
It has a massive heart. And in fact, if you did a scan of a giraffe's heart, well, first of all, you'd need a very long ladder. It's pretty tricky to do. But if you looked at that scan, you would diagnose that patient, if you like, with a very severe heart problem called hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, which is not compatible with long-term life. And yet that is normal for the giraffe to achieve those blood pressures.
Yes. High blood pressure is a no-no for us sapiens, isn't it?
Absolutely, and even more remarkable, despite that crazy blood pressure and thick heart, giraffes suffer from hardly any heart disease. And again, you know, if we thought about that and tried to investigate why, then that may open the door, for example, to treatments for, you know, very common conditions like high blood pressure and heart disease. Mm.
Do you think, I mean, just back to the pig example that I gave at the beginning, there was famously last year, wasn't it? I think in January last year, the transplantation of a pig in a pig's heart, which had been genetically modified into a human, with that human's entire consent, etc., because they knew that this was seriously the last chance at life for them. I think he lived for 2 months before he died. Not in a philosophical way, but in a medical way. Do you think this is a path that we could go down? In other words, just back on the equivalence of humans and animals, we share systems, but do we really, or could we share tissues? Do you think?
Yeah, you're right. This has been used for decades in various types of medicine. You know, you've mentioned we've long used porcine or pig's heart valves, and that still happens today. And there are advantages of using those over metal or artificial valves. And even before that, we've used animal tissue even for things like tendon operations or orthopedic surgery or vascular surgery. So, you know, this has been used for a long time. It'll continue to be used undoubtedly. I guess the big question is that a better option to take rather than developments in mechanical devices and 3D printing and other things? And, you know, I think the jury is out. Like everything, there are good bits and bad bits about it, not least, you know, ethical issues, practical issues in terms of scaling that, for example. And you're right, there hasn't been a successful long-term outcome transplant between organisms, but who knows whether that will happen soon.
Yes, that's right. I know many people with pig heart valves who are just kicking along nicely. Thank you. The other thing about the giraffe, which I found fascinating, was the windpipe. I mean, the mouth is a long way away from the lungs. And as we know, every kid's probably worked this out, you can't have a really long snorkel because it seems a great idea to have a really long snorkel. You think if I just had a hose that would go to the surface, I could just keep breathing through that. But of course you can't. It'll kill you. It's fatal because you can't get enough air out the other end. That's the trouble. And beyond a certain length, and South African jungle tribes know this with their blowpipes, that there's a certain length beyond which a blowpipe doesn't actually work. So you'd think with a giraffe, you know, you can't, how would it work? In other words, how do they exhale, for example?
Yeah, spot on. And thank you for mentioning the South African tribes too. I think this book was loads of fun to write. And one of the reasons it was loads of fun to write is that although it revolves around animals, it also involves patients. It also involves travel to amazing places and meeting the doctor scientists involved in those discoveries. And this was one of those where I found a remarkable lung doctor called Dr. Hugh Jones, who his passion was, yes, it was lung medicine, but he loved travel. And he went to visit some Amazonian tribes, was given a blowpipe, wanted a longer blowpipe, but the chief said, no, you must use this one. And the reason for that was because your height really dictates your lung volumes, how much air you can blow in and out. And so this tribe intrinsically knew that and gave you the blowpipe proportional to your height, because if you blow down a pipe with not enough volume, the dart won't come out the end.
No.
And that's a concept which in medicine, which was described by this physician after coming back, it's known as dead space. In other words, space that doesn't help with ventilation. And after he came back, he also worked in London Zoo and tried to solve many of the issues in humans by looking at animals in the extreme. And there's a famous photo of him holding up a giraffe that sadly died. He prosected the trachea, the breathing pipe, held it up aloft, and he discovered amazing things about that. The way they can breathe through a really long pipe, just like kids with their snorkels is they breathe the same way as maybe tonight during my night shift in intensive care. I may dial up things on the ventilator to treat a patient with asthma. And the way I dial up those dials is the same as a giraffe does. It breathes with a huge volume, much bigger than any other land mammal per kilogram. And it breathes at a very slow rate, which means it minimises the proportion of a breath wasted in that long snorkel, if you like. And that really came, that understanding came through travel, exploring Brazilian and Amazonian tribes and understanding how giraffes breathe.
Mm. Speaking of breathing, there's an interesting section in your book too about what we've learned about the use of ventilators, because the whole COVID pandemic has placed a huge spotlight on ventilators. I mean, have always been used, but of course were used massively and are being used massively in the current COVID outbreaks. Ventilators, though, it seems, do damage lungs and as well as keep people alive. We've learned things about them from the transport of large animals, including transporting rhinoceroses, for example. tell us about that.
Yeah, so intensive care as a specialty is actually relatively new. It was 1952. There was a little girl called Vivi, who was 12, who developed polio in the Copenhagen polio epidemic. And somebody, a doctor called Bjorn Ibsen, made a hole in her neck, attached a bag, squeezed the bag, and then got medical students to keep her alive by squeezing a big balloon, if you like, for days, weeks, and even months. And that little girl, Vivi, survived. I wrote about her in my first book, which is called Critical. And that's really the first time that humans have gone from doing what we call negative pressure breathing, where air is sucked into your lungs, to what we call positive pressure breathing, where air is squeezed into your lungs.
Forced into.
Yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, very few people have ever had this experience unless you've been on an intensive care unit using a breathing machine. And you're right, we now know that giving too much breath through those machines can cause lung damage. We are very careful.
Tell us how. I didn't realise this because I thought, oh, well, the ventilation of lungs would be a wonderful thing. But it actually... Unless you're very careful, it can damage the lung, can't it?
Completely. And, you know, we've been designed by evolution to do negative pressure ventilation, which we've done all our lives. So this new mode is very odd for humans to do. It's less odd if you are a frog. And I'm sure listeners have seen frogs with an expanding balloon under their mouth. The way they sometimes breathe is they expand that balloon. They then contract their cheeks and force air into their lungs, just like that little girl Vivi had done in 1952. So frogs breathe using positive pressure ventilation. And if we'd only looked at that, we would have discovered the right amount of air to blow into lungs. We didn't discover that until around 2000, when there was a big study, and we now know the right amount of air to push in. But frogs have been doing that probably for 20 million years, and they'd use the same amount of air per kilogram that I'll use tonight when working in the intensive care unit.
Yeah, this is the one thing that is fascinating about the book, that is the degree of similarity there is and connection between us and animals. Well, we shouldn't say us and animals. You would say between all of us. We're all animals. Tell me about ants and antibacterials and what we can learn from this.
Well,
because you think an ant nest has got to be, if there's a disease in an ant nest, that's the end of them, surely.
Absolutely. And, you know, ants are not celebrated. I don't know about you, but I don't know when you last found some ants at home. You know, they're considered annoying, pest.
They're negative. Yeah. They're negative for me at the moment because of there's an ant called a termite, which is not in my... Not my favourite insect, dear. I can tell you. But anyway, go on. Yes.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. I've got nothing positive to say about termites in this book. So, but ants actually can teach us a huge amount about how we responded during the pandemic. And like everything in this book, it can't be directly related, of course, but there are real parallels. So outbreaks of infections in ant colonies would happen all the time. They happen much less because ants do the things that us humans struggle to do. They wash their hands. They squirt their friends with antibacterial gel, if you like.
Really?
They use carbonic acid, we use sand gel, but it does the same thing. And even socially distance. When there's an outbreak, they protect the vulnerable, maybe the queen, maybe others in the colony who are very important for food and feeding. They close their schools where the young are brought up. They isolate those because they know they can sometimes be vectors of disease and sometimes they are the most vulnerable ones as well. They even use a form of vaccination by rubbing small amounts of infection off onto their other people in the colony, which gives them some immune protection too. So amazingly, you know, it took us years through the COVID pandemic to work out what may and may not work, but ants have been doing this in colonies for millions of years.
Mm. This one was something I've always puzzled at. Why do some animals seem to be able to stand intense cold? I mean, these are animals with circulatory systems like ours. Now, if you stood outside, even, you know, with some proper clothing in minus 50 or 60 degree temperatures, you would not last that long. But penguins seem to be able to do it. Though you might say, why don't penguins freeze solid?
Yeah.
Or for that matter, and this is a really intriguing one, wading birds who in the Arctic, why don't their legs freeze solid? You instance the whooping crane, for example, which wanders around in sub-zero temperatures and strangely doesn't seem to get much numbness in the toes at all.
Absolutely. You can now understand how bored my friends must have been in the pub when I'm constantly talking about these weird creatures and why don't penguins' feet freeze rather than listening to the pub quiz.
Because if humans stood without shoes on socks on ice, well, that would be the end of us.
Yeah. And we are pretty interested in cold in medicine. Mm. There's lots of diseases and conditions such as cardiac arrest when people's hearts stop in the community. Hopefully they'll have good quality early CPR, which is really important. And so for listeners out there, you know, that would be a great thing to do in terms of educating themselves about first aid and CPR. But one thing we do in the hospital often is we cool down patients and we cool them down to try to protect their brain and prevent any further brain injury. Now, we're not entirely sure whether cooling definitely works. There's some big trials.
This is
happening.
Interesting, isn't it? There's not. I understood the science on this is not at all settled. There's a belief that and even quite radical cooling, you know, taking patients' temperatures right down, might have. But the evidence seems to be a bit mixed, doesn't it?
It's very mixed, and in fact, Australia was really at the forefront of much of this research for many decades, and cooling was very routine post cardiac arrest. And now the pendulum has swung back. We now think that getting hot after a cardiac arrest isn't a great idea. But perhaps radical cooling is less of a good idea. And there are ongoing trials to look at this. But as a result, there are lots of machines which cool down patients. And these machines are quite new and fancy and expensive. And they use super cold water on gel pads which stick to the skin and have feedback loops and so on. And companies have probably made lots of profit from this. They think it's a very clever machine, and of course it is. Unless you were to travel to Alberta in Canada, which is what I did, and meet the whooping crane. And the whooping crane is a large bird which needs to cool itself down in the hot summers and needs to warm itself up in the cold winters. And it does this by standing in water, which is higher or lower than it wants, and using very clever perfusion of its lower limbs, of its feet and its legs, through countercurrent exchange mechanisms, just like in your air conditioning system at home. And so the whooping crane effectively does what we now do for patients after cardiac arrest, using the same theories, the same kind of technology and the same principles.
Yeah, but why doesn't their blood freeze solid?
Yeah,
there can't be much blood in a bird's foot.
You're right.
They haven't got that much covering, and then there's blood in that foot. I mean, it's just going to freeze solid, isn't it?
Yeah. So partially that would be a problem. It does clever things. So it uses what we call countercurrent. So the arteries which have warm blood and the veins which have cold blood run very close to each other, so it can exchange heat very efficiently to prevent that. Some animals go to even further extremes and actually put additions in their bloodstream to prevent ice crystals and freezing. For example, carp, Russian carp that live in super cold water below zero, actually add alcohol to their bloodstreams to reduce freezing. Now, again,
why do they use that? They put antifreeze in their blood.
It's pretty much antifreeze. Yeah, it's a non-ethanol based alcohol to prevent freezing. They can also raise their blood sugars very high, which kind of does something similar, a bit like adding salt to a frozen road. And again, this seems weird, and you know, so what? What's the point in that? Well, we've mentioned heart transplants already, and human-to-human donation is a big thing, and in this place, Australia, it's a big old piece of land, and transporting organs for donation is technically very tricky. And so preventing ice crystals forming when we cool organs for human donation, for example, is a really important problem that we need to solve, and it may be that creatures like the carp and like others could help us.
Mm. I'm talking with Dr. Matt Morgan. He wrote a book called Critical, which you may have read. He's an emergency physician, and his new book, One Medicine, is subtitled How Understanding Animals Can Save Your Life. And the parallels between what happens in animal health and human health are quite close. And there's a whole lot of things that we can learn, including putting up with the cold. Speaking of extremes, some birds can fly at 40,000 feet. Mm. How on earth would you can't? No human could possibly survive at that altitude.
No,
because there's not enough oxygen, and also the extreme cold would kill you.
Yeah, it's a completely remarkable feat. And again, until we have people flying at those altitudes through using commercial air flight, you know, you'd never believe that were possible. But there's some great documented cases of this happening. The highest altitude is about 40,000 feet by a griffon. And there's a great recording, you can listen to the sound recording of the pilot being amazed that, you know, they're at cruising altitude, and out of their window they can see this bird, which caused some minor damage actually to that aeroplane, which landed safely. The way they do that, well, you know, the truth is we don't fully understand. We don't fully know. There are certainly things that they do to their blood, their hemoglobin, which normally binds oxygen, which is why our blood is red in humans, is slightly different from our hemoglobin. It's more like the hemoglobin of babies. They also breathe in a very different way. They exchange oxygen and carbon dioxide much more efficiently than human lungs can. And again, this may have some lessons for us. You know, we've seen in COVID, people with severe COVID pneumonitis, certainly in the first wave. I worked in an intensive care unit in the UK in wave one of COVID, and you know, it was a remarkable, terrifying time where we saw young, healthy adults with the lowest amount of oxygen I've ever seen in patients' blood. And using some of the techniques like this, or even blood substitutes in the future, you know, that it may pave the way for that.
Yes, exactly. Because if birds, which are, well, these birds that fly at 40,000 feet are not small birds either. If they could,
no.
If they're doing it, they've obviously got a means to transport oxygen around their bodies, which must contain, an extraordinary opportunity, you'd think, for humans.
Yeah. And there are some drugs, actually, which can increase the binding of our normal hemoglobin to oxygen, which have been used in experimental scenarios. And, you know, there are also problems sometimes with blood not being able to bind oxygen. Now, when we initially have a blood transfusion, people think, oh, well, blood is blood. But actually, a blood transfusion isn't normal blood. You know, it's got various additives to it. It's often cold. It's been in storage for a while. So if there are ways of us making stored blood more effective for patients with trauma or with other problems with cancer, for example, then that would be a great thing too.
Mm. I'm talking to Dr. Matt Morgan. His book, One Medicine, is about animals and what we can learn from animals as well. All right, tell us about what we can learn from midges and mosquitoes that has led to better hypodermics. You better tell us about the story of the fellow who tried to walk around the world and what got him in the end.
Yeah, I guess there's two stories here. First of all, it's the story of the midgie in Scotland. And if anybody's been to Scotland, during certain seasons of the year, there are these tiny biting flying insects called the midgie, which have been estimated to cause the Scottish economy, you know, millions of pounds a year, because it puts tourists off so much. They are intensely itchy bites. And there was a great, terrible story of a school teacher who wanted to walk around the world and amazingly did it, got something like 50 miles away from his house in Scotland and quit and gave up because of the midgie. You know, it was so unpleasant. So that's one part of the story. I guess the second part of the story, and the reason I'm chuckling, is in the UK, I've been writing this book for a few years, and there was a tough time during COVID where I just had to put the pen down and think about other things. But the time I picked that pen back up to finish it, I went away to a small Scottish island called Eilean Shona. It's where Peter Pan was written. It's a beautiful island in the west coast of Scotland. And one reason I went there is for seclusion, isolation, to write. It's got no electricity, no gas. It's very isolated, and that did the trick. It worked. But the other reason I went there is because I wanted to take all my clothes off, cover myself in honey, and purposely get bitten by the midgie. Now, that seems strange. Perhaps it is strange. But the reason I wanted to do that and the reason I did it, all the photos are under lock and key on my phone, I'm pleased to say, is because when you get bitten by the midgie and the mosquito and other things, it often doesn't hurt when it first happens. It's after that it hurts.
Yeah.
And so I thought, surely, if a creature can bite you effectively with no pain, there must be adaptions for that in medicine. You know, what about your listeners with diabetes? What about people having vaccinations or children having...
Fear of needles could cease to be if it never hurt.
Absolutely. You know, perhaps people would get even more tattoos than they already are. So looking at the technology of these biting insects, they do amazing things to reduce pain. They insert needles in a very similar order to now we use in hospitals, which we know reduces tissue damage. They vibrate these tiny needles at a certain frequency, which is the same frequency used in machines like TENS machines, which are used to reduce pain in pregnancy and other things. And they do other remarkable things with the flow of blood, seeking out blood vessels and so on. So another great adaption. And I'm glad to say I had about 80 or 100 midgie bites, but I did survive.
Glad to hear it. I'm glad to hear it. Do we have any understanding of why and what could we learn from this? Because a lot of people are obsessed by long life. It's not an obsession shared by everyone I know, but a lot of people are obsessed by long, long life. I would rather prefer, I think, a healthy life. But why do some animals live for a very long time? Turtles, for example, the Galapagos turtle famously can live in excess of 150 to 160 years. The Greenland shark, I think, holds the record. No, not the record, is the longest lived species that we know about. It's quite a big animal, and it lives for more than 250 years.
It is remarkable, and of course,
What do we learn from this?
Yeah, and you know, people look at human longevity, and if you look at the average life expectancy over the last, you know, couple of hundred thousand years, yes, it's changed a lot. But what hasn't changed actually is that upper limit of age. Often it's infant mortality rates which affects average life expectancy a lot, but the top age of a human hasn't actually changed at all.
No.
And in the book, I interview Sister Andre, who is currently one of the world's oldest people, who's a nun in France who has seen, you know, multiple world wars and technology advance incredibly well. And I compare her to some of these animals you've mentioned, like the shark, and also a crazy-looking animal called the naked mole rat. And if people want to Google naked mole rat, be careful the results that come up. But the correct animal is a crazy-looking creature with a hairy, stouty nose, no fur on it at all. But it's remarkable. You know, it doesn't get cancer. It can have babies at the very end of its life, which would be the equivalent of humans having babies into their 100-year-old birthday, for example. They tend not to get many of the degenerative diseases that humans get, like arthritis and heart disease.
I just googled a picture of them. They look hideous.
They do. They won't win any beauty competitions, that's for sure. But the things their body does to do that, there's lots of genetic changes. There's lots of ways that early cancer cells are spotted early and thrown out of the body, for example. Their metabolism is very slow. And again, we can't use direct comparisons. You know, this won't allow you to live forever if you only eat supplement X or Y. But there are cancer drugs being developed which use similar techniques, so-called checkpoint inhibitor drugs, for example. And you may have seen on the news this week, there's a famous multimillionaire who's developing techniques for longevity, you know, based around kind of similar concepts to how the naked mole rat lives.
Just finally, what do we know about the mental health of animals? I mean, do animals get sad? Do animals commit suicide?
Yeah, good question. You know, the truth is we don't know, and it's hard to embody the mind of anyone else as a human, yet alone an animal. There have been famous cases of animal suicide. There's a famous bridge in Scotland called Dog Suicide Bridge, where many, many dogs have apparently jumped off to their death, which many people thought was on purpose. There is a spoiler alert, and the spoiler alert is this probably wasn't deliberate self-harm or suicide. This is probably due to the structure of the bridge, the water running underneath, and various smells around there, for example. But there are certainly lessons we can learn from animals about mental health. The book contains a story of a chap called Kevin Hines, who was one of the 2% of people who jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge and survived. And he started a remarkable charity to support those at risk of suicide and self-harm. And he's partially been helped through support animals. And his life actually was partially saved due to an animal, which you can read about in the book. There's also a lot to learn, I think, about grief and loss from other animals. You know, it's been an experience, sadly, many people have had of through the pandemic, where maybe they haven't been able to see their loved ones who are at the end of their life. And there's great evidence from primates that touch around death, being around people who have died, being there as a community can reduce rates of things like PTSD and adverse grief reactions. There's an iconic photo of a primate called Dorothy who died in Cameroon, and a spontaneous gathering of her friends, if you like, of that community, which looks like and kind of is a funeral. You know, animals have funeral rites and they go through similar things to what humans kind of do. So, yeah, I think there's a lot to learn from that too.
Look, the book is fascinating, but it also raises many, many questions of the kind that we're talking, even very existential questions too. It's called One Medicine. My guest has been Dr. Matt Morgan. He's an intensive care doctor who's up close with life and death every day and has been through these COVID pandemics too. Matt, it's been fascinating to talk. Thank you.
Phil, thank you so much. And I'm just going to leave your listeners with one final thought, which perhaps summarises the book. It's from Winnie the Pooh, and it says, "Some people talk to animals, but not many listen, though. That's the problem."
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.